Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is June the 14th, 1999, and in the location of the Quinanier Creekside this evening is a presentation by Jennifer McQuickard, Technology and Ethics, Technologies and the Ways of Living. The number is 99-1, and let's listen in.
Also recently gotten interested in technology and ethics for a couple of reasons. One is I have two very good friends who are at opposite ends of the spectrum with regard to technology. My one friend, Dan Spencer, believes that all technology is evil as he sits under fluorescent lights. I have another friend who loves technology so much he took me to go see the movie Lawnmower Man the moment it came out because he's so excited about the possibility of virtual reality and being able to hook up into a bodysuit and pretend like you're somebody else. He wants to pretend. Yeah.
So we are rather different.
You are rather different. You have the same similar interest, but you take very different positions. He can't wait to be able to pretend like he's Madonna and actually have Madonna's body and do things as Madonna. At any rate, so I have to interact with these two people. And I tend to take more of a middle ground, and when I told some students of mine that I would be teaching a technology and ethics class up at Holden Village where they had no telephones, they said, well, I guess you know your audience, don't you? in terms of not being real fans of technology. So the one thing, what I have advertised this session to be about is looking at how technologies affect the way that we conceptualize the world and how technologies shape the way that we live in the world. And so what I'd like to do, what we're gonna do is spend a little bit of time talking about the introduction of technologies at the beginning of the 20th century and at the end of the 19th century, just so we can have an idea about what sorts of technologies were introduced 100 years ago, what technologies 150 years ago people would have thought were just unimaginable. And as each of these technologies were introduced, people thought they were just the most horrible things to have ever been thought of. It was a sign of impending doom and the end of civilization as we know it, because technology was evil. These are all things that we pretty much, at least I, take completely for granted. One more thing in terms of a preface is, as I've been talking with different people about technology, my take on technology is that in terms of what is technology, is that human beings are technological beings. It is part of our nature in terms of our acting naturally is to create things. So the moment that we pick up a rock and we use it to hammer in a stick, that's technology. So and I know that most people who say that all technology is absolutely bad are hopefully have their tongue in their cheek while they're saying it. Because if we take that sort of position, we're going to be very quickly led to the position that chairs are evil and watches are evil.
At least they're being partially hypocritical, right?
Exactly. if nothing else. And since I'm a philosopher, I believe very strongly in consistency. So what I'd like to do is just take a few moments and just sort of go through some of the things that were introduced at the beginning of this century, and then have us all talk about how these technologies have shaped the world that we currently live in. And these are some of the more fun things. I suspect there were probably more obscure things that were also invented. This was known as the Industrial Revolution, the early 20th century, late 19th century, and one of the big things that happened during that time period was basically mass production. Many of these things had been made before, but they weren't available to many people. In terms of mass production, pencils, pens, and papers, for the first time at the beginning of the 20th century, were actually accessible to just about everybody. For about a dime, you could buy either a dime or a nickel. You could buy a pencil. That's a very big deal. Automobiles, for the first time, were actually available to everybody. A Kodak camera you could buy for $25. Along with that, you would get enough film for 100 pictures, plus the developing costs for 100 pictures. Newspapers and magazines, for the first time, had very widespread publication. For the women in the group, people who stay home and take care of kids, these were very important things. The washing machine and the refrigerator, also important to women who were going to be staying at home, was the commercial canning of food, cereal, and mass production of flour. things that I think most people today pretty much take for granted, but this was a brand new thing at the beginning of the 20th century. Other things that happened in terms of widespread use was the municipal water supply, as well as a sewage system. And this was motivated mostly by health concerns, not by people's desire to not have to haul water back and forth from a well, but there were some serious health concerns. Central heating and electric lighting came into being. Telephones became far more widespread. Movies, indoor bathrooms, a personal favorite line, and trains. Interestingly, with the widespread use of trains came the introduction of a standardized time. Prior to the railroads, there was no standardized time. Each city or each community determined what time it was by when the sun was directly overhead, that was noon. And depending on where you live, when noon was would vary dramatically. It didn't matter because most people spent most of their time in town. But with the railroads, as they crossed across the nation, they had to have some sort of regulation. So they introduced standardized time. The other thing that was introduced at the beginning of the 20th century were elevators, which becomes very important as you look at in terms of things that have been shaped by technology. Architecture was shaped by technology. With the introduction of elevators, all of a sudden it became possible or a lot more practical to have high rises. You could have built high rises before, but you're not going to get many people willing to walk up 19 flights. So these are some of the things that were introduced at the end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century. Let me ask you now, how have these technologies shaped the world that we live in today? How do they shape the late 20th century?
Well, there's been refinement. I mean, I'm thinking of the washing machine that my grandmother used was a very laborious thing to use. As opposed to, or in contrast to the washing machine which I use, is out. That's what I mean by refinement.
The other thing I started, this may not be what you're asking, Jennifer, but it's striking to me who had access to all these things, because that second list you had, the widespread use of, I'm just thinking the communities we visited in Nicaragua,
yes.
Virtually every one of those is not true of those. There's no municipal water supply, sewer system, central heating, electric, telephones, movies, canned food, very little of that is accessible there.
Right. Basically what happened was things shifted from being available only to the upper class to now being available to the upper and the middle class in the United States.
In the first and third world,
right.
It begins to really separate now.
I'm looking at it as a teacher, and every single one of those technologies is essential for the school. I mean, actually, even as small as it is, it's even as an elevator. But it must have changed the education dramatically.
Mm-hmm. And what are some things that you think would have dramatically changed education?
Well, pencils, pens, and papers, newspapers, indoor bathrooms,
buses.
Heating, central heating. All that made possible a great consolidated schools, which may not have been a good idea.
But definitely, I think that, right, the consolidated schools, I mean, you probably can argue against that, but the widespread use of pencils, pens, and paper definitely changed education.
Mm-hmm.
People started writing more. People simply did not write.
Literacy became sort of an achievable standard then.
I think about how much telephone has changed just in my lifetime. When I was growing up, long distance phone calls are something you made only like in emergencies or rare kinds of things, and call grandma once a year. And now that's evolved into email, faxes, I mean, all the kind of stuff we use telephone lines for just in that short amount of time is pretty phenomenal.
Another big impact on our social structure is the use of automobiles. The mobility of people became widespread.
And that the effect on architecture too. Elevators and automobiles.
Mm-hmm. Electric lighting and manufacturing. And you could run more shifts.
I think the newspapers and magazines and telephones, the communication, I think that's probably in my mind one bigger.
Central heating is kind of important to me. I remember when I had to go and start the fire first one at my school.
At school?
The central heating and electric lighting also greatly affected architecture, because you could build houses differently now that you didn't have to have everybody use the same room to keep warm.
And it's really striking, too, what things are not invented yet here. I mean, when you talk about the communications revolution, but there's no radio yet, there's no television yet, there's those kind of things, and so...
Well, the other interesting thing about automobiles, and this, I think, is pretty easy to track, just in terms of how, the widespread effect of the car on at least U.S. society. When you think about it, so much of our land is devoted to parking lots and roads. I mean, that's just a huge amount of land is devoted to that. The other thing that came with the automobile was the introduction of the family vacation. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, they became responsible for people to pile into the car and go somewhere else. But the automobile also...
Where would we be without the structure, the structure of cities, too? The invention of the suburbs.
Yeah, without the car, you wouldn't get the widespread suburbs because everybody had to stay in. And in fact, if you look at just in terms of transportation, there's a difference between the cable car, with the streetcar, the cable car, and the automobile, and it allowed cities to get larger and larger in terms of suburbs. The other interesting thing in terms of family vacation between the automobile and trains, people used to take trains for their family vacations, and what that meant for the naturalists who were in the crowd was that you basically drove through scenery. Mm-hmm. You got to wave as you went by, sort of like being on a ride at Disneyland. You got to go through things. With the introduction of the automobile, people on their family vacations could actually stop, get out, and and start to interact with the geography.
That's one I would differ a little bit on, only because the trains were actually what opened up the national park system. And so you would take a train to Yellowstone, you would take a train to Glacier, and then people, what they did was usually take pack train trips. I mean, so then they were out, you know, doing horse trips or pack trips, stuff like that, but the automobile opened it up to many, many more people.
Instead of the
illegal.
But there were trains going to the Grand Canyon before automobiles.
Yeah, the trains used the national parks, they developed the national parks as a way of developing their passengers. Northern Railroad and Glacier Park are so
great. Have you ever seen the East Glacier stop right in front of the hotel? It's the turn of the century architectural wonder. Yeah.
So if it weren't for trains, then we would have the national park system?
Well, it's interesting because the use of the backcountry actually dropped quite a bit after the automobile, because the trains used to bring in lots and lots of folks, and then once they got to the park, the only way to get them to the park was horseback trips, hiking, things like that. So there was a huge boom in the 1910s, 20s, and 30s. Automobile came in, and then people were able to drive directly, and then actually, by the way, it happens people being able to just drive through parks. I mean, they sort of drive through and stop on the side of the road and stuff.
Stop.
But there was much less actually getting out of the countryside.
Using their camera.
And they developed roads, developed roads through the parks instead of the trail systems. But anyway, your point is well taken, though, because mass transportation, both automobiles and trains, opened up enormous amounts of the U.S. Mm-hmm. to people that otherwise simply would not have been accessible.
Mm-hmm. Also, in the commercial canyon, that was the jumping off for vacuum packed foods, frozen foods, a wider distribution of home freezers, the whole food accessibility to people changed enormously.
Yeah, people's diets changed incredibly.
Yes.
Because now they could have variety instead of being limited to
one. And half white bread came in.
Dried breakfast cereal in boxes.
Yeah, Kellogg's and Post took off.
Yeah.
Where would we be?
The introduction of major corporations.
And that's sort of the flip side of all this. You know, descending what people praise this for is the democratization of all of this. Yeah. Is that the masses now have more access to stuff? But at the same time, it was that time period where the big corporations were really beginning to build. And there was also huge consumerism because now the corporations were starting to build. They had to find consumers, and so there was a lot more advertising, which also added to the increase in terms of newspaper and magazine distribution. Because now that they need a lot more advertising.
So we live in a
But
we live in a small town, and it's interesting when you dig back into the history of the town. It was almost a self-sufficient community at one time. It had many different industries, and those industries are all gone now. Those industries dated from around the turn of the century, and they did for the people then what the national corporations, international corporations do for us now. And so there's been a tremendous centralization of production. It look, seems maybe like it's decentralized, but it isn't really compared with what it was 100 years ago.
And it has its good points and its bad points. I mean, it can affect small towns incredibly, but at the same time, it can help lots of other people in terms of migration.
Yeah, I'm not putting value on
yeah,
it. It just happened.
Yeah, it's a tough call.
One thing that kind of bothers me is of centralization of a lot of these things, that consolidation of companies that were competitive before. Like, you know, one company did
monopolies.
Yeah, monopolies, yeah.
And then you broke up
Well,
now, you said earlier that some of these, most all of these are treated as if they were sort of very, very disturbing. Mm-hmm. Are you going to say more about that?
Well, they were not, I mean, the best example I have is in terms of the automobile. People were very wary about the automobile. Just in terms of it's being very different, and I think the same was true of electric lighting. Men, interestingly, were more opposed to indoor bathrooms than the women were, which doesn't seem to me to be a huge shock. and so a lot of these people were very afraid of simply because they were new. The automobile, I mean, what the automobile did was it replaced the horse. That's probably moderately obvious. People were very afraid because they thought the horses were dependable and all this sort of stuff. But the automobile did a lot in terms of health risks. I mean, just in terms of getting rid of health risks. I have the statistic here. Man, I never really thought about this. I always thought this sort of nice romantic vision of horses and all sorts of things.
Oh yeah, New York City was a mess.
One estimate calculated that New York City's horse population deposited, this is sort of icky statistic, 2.5 million pounds of manure and 60,000 gallons of urine on the city streets each day. Each day. Yes. And the other thing that was nice about cars is that cars didn't get sick. In 1873, but it's not widespread epidemics.
There was a cure, too.
That there was a disease that wiped out about, let's see what I have here, in 1872, an epidemic killed one-fourth of the horse population, which brought the entire country to a grinding halt for about 3 months.
Yeah.
I mean, just grinding halt. You couldn't, by winter, the financial losses suffered helped bring on the panic of 1873. In many cities, teams of men pulled carts and wagons as homes went without fuel deliveries, fires blazed unfought, and garbage remained uncollected. What ended this epidemic was winter, which came and killed all the mosquitoes that were carrying the disease around. So, for my friends who are inclined to romanticize the past and say, oh gosh, the automobile is so horrible, such egregious things, which I agree with, the alternative of horses is not profoundly
Both of those point out is also the context in which the technology
yes.
is used, because automobiles and horses are the exact same in the sense of when you get too many automobiles in a city, you get gridlock, you get an unworkable system, and
yeah.
it may just simply be the cities and the massive urban culture
yeah.
has constraints for both horses. Horses are fine if you have a large agrarian rural society, and automobiles also, if you have low enough density, can do that, but the concentration gives you either smog or...
Well, the other thing that I think it points out is that it's, and it's something that I'll be talking about throughout all of these sessions, is that when people are first introduced to a technology, they can see the horrors of what it's replacing, and so it seems like a really good idea to adopt it.
Yeah.
And it's very difficult to predict what's going to happen. My students will often talk about all the evils of television, although they've all been raised on television. And we talk about the fact that so many children watch so much TV all the time and how television has shaped our culture. But what I try and point out to them is that folks were not idiots. I mean, it is not the case that people introduced TV and thought, oh, this will be a great babysitter. People thought that television was a flash in the pan, that it wouldn't last, nobody would care about it. I remember personal computers in about the 1980s when there was a prediction that by 1990,
everybody would own a computer. And I remember people just laughing at that possibility. So I think one thing that is very true about us is that we adopt things and they seem like they're okay at the time, and we have a very difficult time trying to predict or anticipate what's actually going to happen with these technologies. But the reason that I put these up on the board was not to argue for or against these, but just to say, you know, that technology has shaped the world that we currently live in dramatically, and that if you go back 100 years, you get a dramatically different world.
I'd like to just call our attention to an area that technology has affected us tremendously since the turn of the century, and that is in agriculture. If you look back, you know, the reaper, tractors, which is, I suppose, an offshoot of automobiles, we couldn't possibly raise the kind of food that we're raising today, except for the technological revolution that's taken place.
However, farming has changed so much from the time. My son is on the farm now, and his grandfather, he started on $100. He had a team of horses and a disc and a drill.
That's exactly the point I was trying to make, that technology has driven that change.
Yeah.
It's also made it just a used farm. It's an unprofitable enterprise, if you're going to go. You have to invest $250,000 up front to make a living of $15,000, $20,000 a year.
Yeah, he has a cousin that wants to be a farmer. He's never lived on a farm. But so he told him what you should do. What he told him you should do is you should get a job and you should save about $200,000, and then you'd have enough to start farming if you bought secondhand equipment.
Buy shares in agribusiness.
And so he said, what you do then is forget about farming, put the money in the bank and live off the interest.
One question that I do want to get to as we approach the end of this session is, do we control technology, or does technology control us?
The latter.
Yeah, it feels like it's the latter.
Well, we can get to that question.
We've already assumed it shapes us. So
yeah,
it shapes us. But is the technology a tool? And it's neither good nor bad. It is an it. I mean, mm-hmm. It's a tool, and if it's our use, our application.
That is a position that exists in the world.
So do you want to get to that right now?
We could get to that right now. The other thing we could get to right now is how technology has shaped life at Holden.
I think
we might have both conversations going on.
Yeah. How has technology shaped life at Holden?
Well, I wouldn't attempt to come here if I had to get here on a horse.
Yeah. It would be rugged if there was no hydroelectric.
You'd never sustain a community of this size in this place without high technology.
And can you imagine winter with the little light, without any other light?
Mm-hmm. Or heat.
Mm-hmm. Well, commercially prepared foods. You can't grow food here.
You'd be cutting it by hand.
Yeah.
No internal combustion engine.
And you'd be sledding it in.
I think the food is, that's incredible. I mean, as I see the hundreds of people who are here now, there's no way that you could raise that food.
Simply couldn't exist.
Couldn't raise the food here. I mean, the soil just isn't conducive to it.
Or the season either.
Rhubarb. Whole climate stuff.
Are there any other technologies that shape Holden?
Well, as community life has been transformed enormously by videos, televisions in the last 10
years. It's only a contested one, too. And there'll be cell phones within the next couple of years, won't it?
Yeah, right. But, the point I'm trying to make is just that part of the point. I remember sitting in Quentin Fireside in 1981 watching Seven Brides for Seven Brothers on a reel-to-reel.
film. So, you know, we're using technology to entertain ourselves. But that was the exception and not the rule. Most of the time, we had talent shows or put on skits or whatever, entertain ourselves. Yeah. Now, because it is so easy and simple, people have video collections that bring in or they can rent them from Dow Lake and they come up on the boat.
Is there going to be any technology that Holden will reject for philosophical reasons?
I was wondering in a way about the amplification of musical sound in an environment that you really kind of in a way would like it to be quiet, and that yet even for worship we're doing loud noise.
And there is a dependency on stereo, I mean this is being taped right now.
I like the fact that there are no telephones here, but someday probably there will be cell phones. Is that what you're saying?
Well, there'll be satellite phones.
Satellite.
Yeah. Okay.
It's
do we really want them here?
The technology is even like the TV is it's a conscious ongoing debate here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think it's a legitimate one.
The disposable diapers, the hair dryers, the.
In the winter, though, you can't use a hairdryer in the toilet because you pump one of those things in and suck 1,500 watts out of
stop.
I don't know how many are available, and
And if you say nuts, I'll just do it anyway, they'll threaten to cut the coffee machine off.
That would be serious.
Well, I mean, I was pretty surprised to see a hairdryer in the summertime.
Yeah, it's in the literature not to use them here.
Does that mean
that I heard it this morning when I went down the hall?
We were told not to bring them hair dryer. Mm-hmm.
Question is why?
Yeah.
I mean, it's different. I mean, in the winter, if you use the hair dryer, you blow the electric supply. Now, if you use the hair dryer, actually, it's not a problem at all. We got lots of energy.
You just you have your neighbors kind of looking down their noses at you.
It seems to me this is a very high-tech environment here, really. Without high technology, Holden wouldn't exist. But if you look at the Amish, then that really, I think, truly is a low-tech society. Some use a telephone if it's in a booth outside the house, but some don't use a telephone at all, I don't think. And they're getting along. They're being, even today, being successful farmers.
Not in a place like this, though.
Oh, no.
Well, I understand that farmland is some of the most productive because they haven't destroyed it with the heavy machinery and with the fertilizers and pesticides.
And they don't spend much either.
That's right. They live there. They're very low on the on the consumption scale.
Well, and also in that community, there's a designated family that makes the grape nuts. For the community. There's a designated family that makes the noodles for the community. So everybody's not doing everything. You know you can go and pick up what you need.
Well, that's a discipline that sort of appears here at Holden. It's not about technology, but there's a way where everything is sort of transparent, and you know who does what in the community. If you're at least bit interested, you can find out. And that, I think, is intentional. And I think it affects how the technology is used and how we think about it. I'm not sure that that's why if Holden is any different.
Then what? If Holden is any different.
Then what? The outside world, as it were?
Well, if that has made Holden different than the outside world or other communities where I live in a little town of 600, so it's almost comparable in the summer. Mm. But I don't always know who's doing what. There's a lot of inputs and outputs here. The tools that are used are up. You know who does the things. You know who uses the tools.
The thing I find interesting is the comment Colleen made earlier, saying, well, it's just a means to an end, right? It's just a technically means in Greek. And that's been my argument, but I'm also interested in the argument that the technologies can shape the ends.
Oh, I think so.
And that might be an interesting question just to test in relationship to Holden. Has technology changed the ends, the purpose of Holden? I don't know. And if we don't want to talk about Holden, where else might we consider that question?
Well, it's also that one of the difficulties is we can be sort of getting a finger on what we mean by technologies. Because the Amish use technologies. I mean, they use plows, they use...
Generators, saws,
and those lines. So, I have to figure, it may not be a question of how do technologies change the ends, but how does the introduction of new technologies or different technologies change the ends?
I have this feeling though that with the Amish, they are conscious about what, and sometimes right and sometimes wrong. I mean, they can't foresee the future, but they at least think about, seriously, about the introduction of a technology. They actually have the community fathers get together and say, should we do this? And we don't do that in the Gentile world, as it were. We just start using the technology.
One of the things that we have at work in the United States is both this desire for community, which I think if you look historically, there has been the interest in community, but also rampant individualism.
Yes.
And so I think those are, that both of those make sense to me. I don't want to be told that I can't have something. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's a huge flaw in my character. I was hoping to make you all feel better because I was expecting you all to want the technologies you want, but you don't want other people to have the technologies they have. But I do think that there's a difficulty because we tend to believe that each individual should have the right to make their own decision about what they want. But then very rapidly we learn that individual choices do affect the entire community. So the question is, when does the community have the right to step in and tell an individual that they shouldn't be doing what they're doing? An example that jumps into my mind is sort of prejudice towards the individual is, as a child, I loved to read, didn't like to interact with people very much. Give me a book, I would be perfectly happy. And I went to visit my grandparents with my sister, who's 4 years younger than me, and talks a mile a minute. And my grandmother got really upset and said that I was disrupting the entire family because I refused to participate with the family because all I wanted to do was go and read a book. So it was this idea that I had made an individual choice based on what I wanted, but my individual choice was affecting the entire family because I wasn't participating. And I greatly resented being told that I couldn't sit and read my books. Now, the reason that I use that example is because I think when we talk about watching TV, it's real easy to go, ooh, evil television. But if you talk about Jennifer reading Oliver Twist, you know, a good classic, it's a little bit more difficult to say, ooh, Charles Dickens, evil. But I think that that's a real tension, and you can see that played out here at Holden, where it seems to me that most of the folks I've spoken to, in terms of the use of VCRs, few people are opposed to VCRs being used in the same way as the movies were, where you have one VCR and the entire community comes and watches it together. The disagreement appears to be more with people who have their individual VCRs who then go to their individual chalets and watch their individual movies by themselves. But there's still this real tension. You know, when is it okay for the community to step in and say, what you're doing is negatively affecting my life, therefore you should stop doing what you're doing?
I think you point out a really good thing, and when you brought up the example of the Amish, I mean, part of what is disappearing so rapidly from our society, which I think makes that decision difficult, is stable communities with community memories that get used as a way. I mean, the Amish very intentionally ask, and they base it on their long history together, and they always ask the question, what will this do to community? Mm-hmm. But most of us don't live in communities like that. We may live in voluntary associations, like once a week going to church or going to the PTA or maybe a neighborhood association. But most of us move in and out of those pretty quickly, and so when there's a conflict between community and individual,
for the most part, very few of us actually live in any sense of integrated community. Mm-hmm. But when there is, the individual almost always wins. And so it's apart from a setting like Holden, it almost seems ludicrous to ask the question, would you voluntarily self-limit yourself for the sake of something larger? And that's what Holden tries to struggle with. And so the question of VCRs is, what's the net effect on community? Because community is a value here. But I would say the vast majority of us now live in mass culture, and so we may have stepped into different associations of people, but I think that's very different than communities that have histories and memories and community values that you're used to think these through.
Is the implication of what you're saying is that if an individual makes a decision not to do something or to do something differently, that it's
about
no value?
Well, it's almost, this is where I think Jim's question about when technology becomes driving the ends and stuff. I found this all the time. I remember very well the first time I heard an answering machine. I thought, oh, that's kind of novel and stuff, but it was kind of like, do I really want to leave this thing on the answering machine? Because it was kind of strange and I felt a little uncomfortable. Now I get really irritated when I call a phone number and there's no answering machine. And the phone just rings and rings. Why don't they have an answering machine? I mean, I have adjusted my interaction patterns on the assumption there. And that was cumulative, millions and millions and millions of individual decisions. But it's shaped the pattern now. Well, I think about the city that Des Moines, that Jennifer and I live in, which up until just a month ago had no rapid transit past 6 p.m., no buses past 6 p.m. Because it just assumed everybody had a car, and if you needed to get to a place after 6 p.m. like a job, you'd drive your car. Well, we have a lot of people in our city that don't have cars, and they simply are that. So in a lot of individual cities to drive cars have structured a social thing without there being any intentional community discussion about it.
Your question of hands, it seems to me, maybe you can comment on this, that these, when I was young, and today, they're still being sold pretty intensively, but mainly as a way to, as convenience and saving labor, so that you can sort of have more, what, leisure?
Yes.
More time?
What's more quality of time?
So you can tent your technology.
Well, I'm thinking that the washing machine, refrigeration, telephones, automobiles, so much of it was to save labor and be convenient and to make life easier.
But it,
for what?
Well, I was going to say it really doesn't.
Yeah.
Because I think our standards of cleanliness within the home are much greater now than they ever used to be. My aunt used to wear a dress to school for a week. You know, most people did. Our standards of cleanliness, because we have the washing machine and the vacuum cleaners and everything, are much higher in the homes than they ever used to be. And women work just as hard with the new stuff, and men too, as they did with...
And automobiles really, I don't think, save time because we use them so extravagantly.
You just go further now.
We go further.
2 hours a day.
So many people are commuting an hour a day or more.
Commuting rather than walking for groceries because the grocery stores.
Well, and also smaller communities are dying as their shopping centers because it's more enjoyable for the family to pop in the car and go to the mall for Sunday afternoon because there's more there and more glitz, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
But the question that raises for me is this a fault of technology, or is this a fault of human beings who seem to be woefully bad at using technology? Because my students, they would sit there and they talk about the evils of technology, this was just horrible, and the internet was just the most horrid thing to have ever been invented. And then I broached the possibility that he might give up his car. I was like, well, no, I need my car.
Yeah.
Why do you need my car? Because if I drive, that helps me to relieve tension. Sort of like, okay. As you brought up, this is what families enjoy doing.
It's family time.
Yeah.
But again, this is where Jennifer and I have these fun conversations all the time. But I mean, to assess technology outside of the context that both produces it and shapes it, I think becomes challenging. Jennifer and I were talking a little bit about the difference between the Amish, who by and large have been successful at resisting most of this kind of things. And Wendell Berry makes the point it's because they're an agrarian community. They can be self-sufficient by food. Whereas the Luddites, who've gotten a really bad name in our society because they were just resisted the Industrial Revolution and technology there, but ultimately were crushed because there was no way of being self-sufficient once. I mean, much of this technology, which is introduced as labor saving, creates a social context of much greater increased dependency. Or you can say it is interdependency. The good side perhaps would be interdependency, but dependency in the sense that very, very few of us are in any sense self-sufficient now. So we rapidly become very dependent on these, and then it's, I think your student's right, it's inconceivable to imagine being able to live apart from them. And it's not only inconceivable in terms of the imagination, for most of us it would be inconceivable practically. I could not live without the industrial agricultural system we have, with the computers that run of these kinds of things. I'm dependent on them.
As is Holden.
As is Holden, yes.
Just to leave open the question of ends, what is it all for? We're using technology more intensively. Is that fair to say that we have higher technologies now and more complicated and ones that make us more dependent?
Oh, more complicated.
More complicated. And
for instance, the old Model T, which many men could fix it no matter what. Nowadays, if you have the car and if you haven't been, educated about how to do it or gone to school for it, you can't fix a car.
On the other hand, it doesn't break down as often now as the old Model T.
That's right.
The irony, it seems to me, is Dan, and I agree with Dan, that I am dependent. I can't use this stuff, or I do half the things that machines do for me, like your computer, and some of the beyond that addition and subtraction and division and multiplication, I'd be lost in the other stuff. But you would think that level of dependence then would make us prize community more, prize our relations with others more, and yet the place where technology gets creamed all the time is for destroying community.
Well,
it's just interesting to me that technology has, at least in the eyes of most people, not functioned to improve community. It's improved efficiency, it's improved leisure, it's improved convenience, it's improved communication, lots of things human beings value, but some people seem to think, or a lot of people seem to think, technology hasn't improved community. And that's interesting.
Well, how about living in a community and not knowing the person who lives across the hall from you or across the street from you?
I can tell you more about Kosovo than I can about Calmer. Calmer's 10 miles away.
And when you have communities, so many people living in a similar area and working here, there, wherever, they often do not know each other. It's not a community. It's just a place to live.
That kind of interdependence that you're talking about doesn't always mean that there is sort of a conviviality.
Yeah.
That dependence can have a strong sort of feeling of victimization.
Well, it's very different than the kind of small town interdependence and self-sufficiency you were talking about that many Midwestern small towns had, and basically now the interdependency is dependency on abstract, large, absent, entities, whether they're corporations or government.
And accompanied by a lot of cynicism, it seems to be.
And most of us are pretty integrated into those in some sort of cogs in the system, but not a sense of having any self-control over it.
This is interesting because, as I've been thinking about Holden, it seems to me that technology does contribute to the community here at Holden. The two examples that come to mind are Dish Team, which seems to be, it seems to be very much a community builder, and just being able to all be in the same place seems like it's a shared experience. And the other that comes to mind, and I thankfully only experienced one of these, but the fire alarm. I mean, that seemed to be a huge, and the fire alarm, this is fairly high-tech fire equipment here. And it seems to me that was a huge community builder. And so but I'm willing to say that technology is going to inevitably destroy community. My suspicion is that human beings, or maybe human beings in the United States, are so individually focused that we have a tendency to take technology and then use it to make ourselves more more independent, or at least not dependent on other people. But I'm not sure it's the technology's fault.
Can you separate the? I mean, I think you can do this probably in the abstract. I don't know if you can. Can you separate technology out of the corporate kind of culture, which by and large either produces it or mass produces it now? I mean, it is possible, I think, still to be an individual inventor. But for it to have any kind of impact, it very quickly has to be absorbed into a corporate economic system so that most of the technology we interact with now is coming out of a market system, a corporate system. And that may be what's a little bit different about some of the technology you're talking about. That technology is being produced, like the dish team there, the hydro, those kinds of things. But it, in some ways, in holding this artificially operating free, a little bit outside that context, and that may be part of the difference.
I think it is mediated here to a great extent by human contact, by face-to-face contact. The people are running the kitchen come forward and say, look, I have a concern here. This is the way I want you to do something. And all of a sudden there's a person who's, if you ignore their request, it's not only that you've ignored the technology, but the person has already appealed to you. And somehow having technology mediated by the user or the expert really sort of, I think that's one thing that helps create community.
I think it is virtually impossible to view technology just by itself. So what I'm trying to do is sort of pull together what the context actually is, and that as people who live in the United States with such a focus on individualism, I think we have to fight our use of technology and sort of how we employ it.
Go ahead.
I just have one comment on new technology, chat rooms and the computers. I mean, we talk about the fact that they keep people from getting together, you know, personally and in community. But if we just redefine our definition of community, there are a lot of people with various diseases and problems that can get on the chat room and find people that are going through the same experience as they are. Mm-hmm. And that is community, that their family can't even provide for them.
And the reason I'm smiling is because I think my second to last session, which I think is Friday, we're discussing that. We're talking about cyberspace and whether or not communities on cyberspace are real community or not. I think that's a really good example, because people have argued that this is where community is being reintroduced. And people have very strong feelings about the people with whom they come into contact on a regular basis, even though they're across the world. So I think that's an example that's been thrown out a lot in terms of how technology has actually aided community.
Well, I was thinking of where would we be in technology in America if we didn't have corporations and advertisement bombarding us in our commercial world in the United States. Mm-hmm. Turn on the television, turn on the radio, you go to the movies, there are these advertisements for this newest technology, and there is a group of people who have to get on the bandwagon immediately and have to have that item. If we didn't have all that commercialism, would we be where we are today in our use and abuse of technology?
Well, the state of our communities. The welfare of our communities. I think the fundamental context here is market capitalism. And the assumptions of market capitalism, that the pursuit of self-interest is good, and that in the end, the pursuit of self-interest by all of us together works magically through the invisible hand to lift the tide for all ships, and there's a bigger pie for all of us to share in. So, and there's a economic ideology that tells you what some of the ends are in life to which technology should be applied. And we have with it, unfortunately, a political ideology in the country, which, this will be an election year coming up, and I'd like to find the first person that says, I'm going to increase your taxes because I know you care about the common good.
Remember what happened to Bruce
Gold?
Bruce Gold.
Don't
tread
on me.
Bruce
Gold. It would be different in my family. If you take a 9-year-old to the toy store, and needs are created.
Yeah.
And you cannot doubt that.
That's
You go home and look in his room and it's half full of toys already.
Well, yeah, the needs, that, and I don't know exactly what to make of that, but I would say in lots of cases, needs are invented by those that make and sell things.
Absolutely.
And Jen, I realize we're not necessarily dealing so much on community, but I think this interaction between community and technology is a fascinating one. Jennifer and I are also co-teaching a course on community in the fall, so we're kind of at least working through a lot of things that we're going to be talking about. But just to toss it out there, I'm really interested in the way we use the word community, because I think what assumptions we make about that may shape whether or not we see technology as benevolent, neutral, or problematic. And Wendell Berry says that community always involves at least two interrelated things. It's collections of people in a place, but it's also the nature, the collection of animals, plants, ecosystems, stuff, also in that place. And one of the things I was thinking about, that may be one of the ways that I'm implicitly evaluating technologies, because I think a lot of the technologies that have been introduced operate as if there were no ecological reality or ecological grounding in there. And secondly, oftentimes have terrible hidden ecological costs that most of us are either not aware of consciously or we don't think about when we use them. And so when we talk like by Holden, Holden tries to make an effort, at least the technology it uses, to have it as much as possible work with the rhythms of the ecosystem here as opposed to against it. And that's part of why it's been so difficult to get a sewer system that's functional in this place. But like the electricity that gets used here is done both through hydroelectric and tries to do it in a way that works with the rhythms here. And so I think, you know, and that's a question I have, because I realize you'll be talking about more later about the cyberspace or the chat rooms and stuff, because I'm always wondering what happens to the rest of the earth in the kinds of communities that we create through technology. Is it made invisible? Is it present? Is it enhanced? Is it harmed? And it's not always clear to me in terms of some technologies. Other technologies seem very clear. But I think it has to do with how we think of community and who. Is it only human beings, or do other things participate in those communities?
I think it's also important, I think that someone could make an argument for those are the sorts of values that ought to shape how we choose our technologies, that the low-impact technologies are better than the high-impact technologies. Because I think that lots of the newer technologies are actually trying to have less of an impact on nature. And that was one of the big arguments for nuclear energy. That if we look at the smaller nuclear plants instead of burning coal or something else, that was actually far lower impact on the environment. But I'm struck by the fact that you all have hit on just about every one of the arguments in terms of the benefits of technology versus the costs of technology. Now, we've had one sort of hypothesis that's been thrown out, that it's all part of market capitalism. If we talk about market capitalism being the cause of it all, does that leave us with very much hope? I'm always struck by the fact that my students are typically very comfortable saying it's all market capitalism's fault. And I say, okay, well, how are we going to change that? And they say, well, we can't. They throw up their hands and they walk out saying we're all just doomed.
I don't know if this is how technology works, but there's pharmacies or the
pharmaceuticals.
Yeah, pharmaceuticals that actually work on finding the right combinations that will treat certain diseases. And the advertising that they do is that their zeal for the technology that will help people is really there, but then because it's a novel drug, they just charge so much for it. You know, so that it's kind of like on the one hand, well, yeah, they really want to help people, but on the other hand, it's very, very expensive to have. And I don't know if that's the same with technologies. Or if you
look at solar panels or any sort of environmental friendly means of getting energy, it's incredibly expensive in terms of startup. After you've had it for a few years, it's supposed to pay itself off, but it's incredibly expensive just from the get-go.
But solar gas and pump be much more expensive if we had if the government was subsidizing petrochemicals. So societies can choose to subsidize things that they want to encourage, and we can choose to tax things that we want to discourage. If as a society we really wanted every person in our culture. this new pharmaceutical research, we could choose to do that. We just need to generate enough political will to direct the money there, and then the rich aren't the only ones that benefit from that new group. So my answer to your question is, the solution to market capitalism is, this is Larry Rasmussen's idea, and he was our dissertation advisor. But it's basically to return to what economics used to be called, and that is political economy. That the polis regulates the oikos, the community determines the rules of the household and tries to figure out how to best, use economics to satisfy the ends of the home, of the polis. But of course we live in a neoclassical or neoliberal economic environment right now, which says hands off, don't fiddle with the goose that lays the golden egg, don't constrain it with regulations, and the pile will get so big you can't imagine it in this finite world that we live in.
In terms of if technology can be stopped, or if it just has a life of its own in this way.
At my understanding of discoveries, early discoveries, that often there were groups of people working on the same things in various places, and the information would be enough so that they would almost be coming upon this at the same time, only they were far apart. And so maybe that's how things are driven, that the more you learn, the more, it's like curiosity, kind of.
I can't see technology being halted. I just see it as a value issue. I mean, decisions are based upon goals, and our goals are based upon our values.
And do you think it would take something as radical as changing capitalism or forfeiting?
I don't think that would make any difference.
Yeah, I don't know if it's...
Technology feeds on the promise of better things for us. And
The market economy
delivers that in a very prime way. The communist system, a socialist system, attempts to do the same thing, only maybe the distribution system is different. But socialists are not against technology.
Well, we could change things in terms of how technologies are currently chosen. This is actually the last day we'll be discussing this, in terms of how we go about choosing what technologies. I mean, right now it seems to be basically the market system. Mm-hmm. That if somebody puts something out there and if people want to buy it, they buy it, great, and we all have car phones. If people don't want to buy it, then they don't buy it, and society doesn't have it. I mean, so right now it's basically market forces. And if you can get enough people to purchase it, then society has it.
I think that we may, for the first time in the consumer society, get into a saturation. I mean, it's almost hard to imagine, but it's
an impression. I may be a dreamer, but I'm thinking that down the line, maybe even within 20 years, a lot of the things that we have that we think are so great right now are going to be, I got an Apple computer in 1980. Well, Apple computers practically passe now because it didn't develop. And so I think that some of these things that we have nowadays are going to be passe by the things that will be here. And because people are always going to be curious about making new things. There are always going to be some who are.
Well, there are signs that the computer market is saturated with personal computers. And there are signs that...
Only in this country.
Yeah. Well, they have to wait on power. But there are other signs, like people... There's a lot of talk in mass culture on meaning and spirituality And there's a lot of poking fun at hyper technologized people in media, I mean, the they're just little signs that it's becoming laughable and becoming something.
One of my high schoolers, I just love it, has a t-shirt that says, "Do you know the difference between your needs and your wants?"
Wonderful.
And I, for me, that is just a sign of hope that that is worn by a high schooler.
I get told that a lot in our home. I will say, "I need something," and I'll be told, "Is that a need, or do you just want it?"
That's my husband's favorite.
Well, that comes down to moral character, being able to decide, distinguish between needs and wants. And so, if you can't change capitalism, maybe you would change the capitalist.
Yes.
I'm suggesting
that had a lot of us Ephesus jobs in the 80s. But on the other hand, I mean, I've told people at my school I'm not interested in teaching good capitalists. I'm not interested in knocking the rough edges off little capitalists. I really do think capitalism is the bigger fish to fry here.
Yep.
And yet, at the same time, you sort of, it's, which end do you start on? Do you start on the character, or do you start on the communities that shape the character, mm-hmm. or do you start on the ideologies that shape the communities?
Well, we gotta get started.
Not suggesting that it may not even be something as noble as a change in character, as much as here we've been at the capitalist consumer table for days and days and months and years, and finally, you just push back with the biggest stomach ache you've ever had. And you just have had enough. I mean, what I think about now when I see a book I want to buy is, God, where am I going to find a room for this? And what, it's at that point in my life, it's saturation, it's physical space is gone.
Yeah. This is the problem with discussions at Holden. Because you get a sort of self-selected group of folks who say, yes, exactly, this is the way. But I'm guessing you all are in the minority, not the majority.
Absolutely.
Yeah. 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 I saw Best Buy on the weekend. I'll tell you, that works a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it doesn't matter what the weather's like.
I could be wrong.
You know, it seems to me there's a better hope about capitalist market system to think in terms of internal inconsistencies that exist in any system that eventually over time change that system. Sometimes they destroy it. And I'm not so sure it's the activities of individuals or it just seems to be part of the organic thing of a system that it, you push it so far and these internal contradictions
surface.
Yeah, they surface and tend to destroy or greatly modify the system.
I have a liberation geology topic.
I have a question for you and Joel. I hope before the week is over, one of you discuss, I don't know if this is science or technology, the fact that companies like Monsanto are trying to create seeds. Yes.
It's one of my favorite
companies.
This just
bothers me so much. I hope somebody talks about it.
We're actually out of time.
No,
we're out.
May I